I cannot see how you can hold elections in those four provinces in 3 months from now, because the devastation is so complete.
Hello, and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, the entirely student-run podcast at Johns Hopkins University. I am Leo Kamer, the host for this episode. On February 6th, two approximately 7.5 magnitude earthquakes struck southern Turkey and Syria. At the time of recording, the death toll in both countries is over 35,000. In this episode, we focus on how the earthquake has affected Turkey specifically, with a look at the country's disaster response, as well as how the event may alter Turkish domestic politics. Joining us to discuss the earthquake and Turkey is Dr. Henri J. Barkey. Henri Barkey is the Cohen Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University and an adjunct senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. As a final note, this episode was recorded on Thursday, February 16th, 2023. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Henri, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To set up the rest of the discussion, how large was the earthquake in Turkey? Where exactly did it occur? And how many people have died and been displaced so far?
First of all, it was two earthquakes. Each were approximately 7.5 on the Richter scale, which is enormous. And it happened in four major provinces. Kahramanmaraş was the epicenter, Adıyaman, Gaziantep, and Hatay. And so far, the number of dead is over 35,000, I think. And this is in Turkey alone. It hit Syria as well. And we don't know how many people got displaced. I mean, it's probably in the hundreds of thousands, because they're talking about a very, very, very large number of buildings that have been now condemned that are unsafe to return to. So what happens to these people? A lot of them will probably disperse all around the country. There's no place to stay there. So that's all we know. I mean, we don't know that much more.
And in the early days of this disaster, with all these collapsed buildings and such, responders and rescue teams were reporting shortages of body bags and cranes and manpower. But this may be understandable given the historic scale of the earthquake. How effective would you say has the Turkish response been?
The response has been actually pretty bad. I mean, the response has been lackluster. I think the government really did not know what to do when the earthquake hit. I think it took them about 2 days for the sizable number of volunteers and rescue people to get to the region. There are some parts that did not get, and I think there are still probably small villages that have not been reached yet. And so the response was actually pretty bad by any stretch of the imagination. And people are very frustrated. You can see it in the reporting that comes out from that part of the country, especially because the government controls the media. So if stuff is coming out, you can imagine how awful people must feel if they will go out and criticize the government directly on television, etc. But they're moving faster now. I mean, there's been a lot of foreign help from all over the world that has come in to help. And they have also been pretty good at rescuing victims who have been buried under deep rubble, because some of these foreign countries have better technological apparatus, or apparatai, I should say. So the Turks have been receiving a great deal of help, but at the end of the day, two things are becoming clear. One, that the government was not ready, and despite the fact that they had raised tax, they had a special tax imposed after the 1999 big earthquake, which killed also a lot of people, but most importantly, they raised the money to be ready for it. What is now becoming very obvious is that the budget of the government or state-sponsored rescue organization was cut significantly in the 2023 budget. And people are also noticing that. That's number one, that they were not ready. Second, and in some ways probably more damaging both to the government and also obviously to the victims, is the fact that in 2018, in an effort to, I guess, look good to the population, also to raise money, the government issued an amnesty for people who had built illegal buildings. For example, you get a permit to build a five-story apartment building, and then you put three more stories without permission on top of that, so you have an eight-story building. Those three should technically be removed or destroyed, but people apply for this legalization, and as a result, in 2018, this amnesty was passed all over the country. Tens of thousands, I would say hundreds of thousands of people had their illegal or shoddy construction amnestied. So in effect, what the government did was to condemn a lot of people to graves, because now we're seeing that those buildings have all collapsed. And this is going to come, and we can talk about this later, but this is going to come back to bite the government. Two very interesting pictures emerged out of this disaster. One was a cultural center that was built in Kahramanmaraş with EU funding. And it is an all-glass building, actually a very beautiful building. And so it was in the eye of the earthquake. I mean, in the epicenter of the earthquake. That building, when you look at the pictures today, hasn't had a crack in its windows. I mean, it's all, as I said, it's all windows. By contrast, a hospital that was across the street from that building is completely demolished. Right, it goes to show that much of this disaster is really man-made, right? And it is the fact that there is so much corruption and there's so much willingness on the part of the government to let people get away with this kind of stuff. By the way, there was another picture. It was the building of the, I think, Structural Engineers Union or something like that, again, in the same town. And you look at the building, every other building around it has been destroyed. That one stands alone, kind of as an edifice to being careful. So I think at the end of the day, people will say, especially now, because there was the 1999 earthquake, and basically what this shows is that no lessons were derived from that earthquake, and this is going to be the most important, shall we say, conversation point in a conversation subject in Turkey for the next months, maybe even years.
And so we have this corruption, which, as you suggest, seems to have caused a lot of the lack of preparedness for this earthquake in the building structures, as well as in the logistics of the disaster response. So I'm wondering, is this corruption a recent phenomenon, or is it something that has plagued Turkey for a long time?
Well, look, we've had corruption in Turkey for a very long time. It's not new. I mean, it is not. I mean, you have corruption in every country. It's just the scale of the corruption that distinguishes one from the other. You have corruption in this country, but it's a scale, and it's also the attitude that the government takes. what happened in Turkey, especially in the construction sector, because Erdogan, the president of Turkey, who's been in power now since 2003, and his party has been in power since 2002, so we're talking about 20 years. During those 20 years, he prioritized the construction sector, because the construction sector not only builds houses and nice buildings, etc., but also is involved in the building of bridges and tunnels and highways, airports. So there's a coterie of building constructors or magnates who have very, very close relationship with the government, and they have received the large share of government contracts. I mean, you can see it. I mean, it's, you know, usually there's five big construction companies that have really done exceedingly well. And so Erdogan has, for political reasons, because building bridges and highways and airports looks good, he has encouraged private sector investment in that. Plus, the government has built a lot. I mean, in fact, I mean, you look at Turkey's infrastructure today. Now you worry about that infrastructure, but they have built huge number of bridges in the last 20 years, and roads and tunnels, etc. So actually, the Turks have a pretty good road infrastructure now. But what people will worry about now is how good that construction is after what happened in this earthquake. But in general, the construction sector has always cut corners. I mean, this is not new, but the scale now is enormous, and this is what we're seeing.
And your answer gets at something broader that I want to ask about. What is Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan's role in the response as a whole? Is he to blame for both the lack of preparedness as well as the sort of on-the-ground response to that?
Look, what Erdogan has done over the last 20 years is he was first prime minister and then created a presidential system where he's the, shall we say, the sole decider on everything. And he has projected this image that he is the father figure, if you want, of Turkey, and that he decides everything. He, you know, if this bridge going to be built, it's his decision. So everything, he has kind of created himself, and he is, it's not necessarily wrong. I mean, he is at the center of everything. That was done for political reasons, because he's created a populist authoritarian system. And in the process, he also has undermined the independence of every single societal and government institution that should be independent. For instance, there is no independent judiciary. If somebody goes to jail, I'm talking about not for a thief or necessarily a murderer, but especially political figures, it's all because Erdogan wants them to. Political parties get banned, political leaders get banned. I mean, this is all Erdogan's decision, and the judicial system has lost its independence. There is no rule of law in Turkey. But the same thing can be said for the central bank, for universities, for the press. You name the institution, he controls that institution completely. So he decides where universities are going to build, who's going to be essentially a professor, or his cronies decide that. And as a result, because he has projected this image, and it was convenient for him to be essentially the father figure, as I said, that you look at him for all important decisions, he's not responsible. He bears responsibility for the destruction in this earthquake because he put himself there. Right? He's trying to blame contractors, saying, oh, they did shoddy work. Well, they did shoddy work, but you legitimize that shoddy work. right? So it's going to be, he's really in deep trouble now because of his total control over all state institutions. So there is no one to blame except him. I mean, or the edifice that he has created.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's sort of a double-edged sword there. So moving to a more future-looking question, we have this rescue process, which is improving in quality in large part due to international aid. And so my question is, what happens next? We have cities that have been destroyed and many people displaced. We don't know exactly how many, as you said, but certainly hundreds of thousands at least. What is the next step in Turkey's response to the earthquake after it saved as many people as it can?
Well, I mean, here's another, shall we say, interesting tidbit. Erdogan is now saying, oh, within a year, we're going to rebuild everything. Well, when you look at the destruction, I mean, think of a 10-story building that has collapsed. I mean, cleaning that up itself will take a long time, not to mention that they still don't know how many bodies are lying underneath that rubble, right? And then you're going to clear all that and you're going to rebuild within a year, should we say, a similar building or something bigger maybe or whatever, and hopefully up to code rather than shoddy. You can't do that in a year. That's physically impossible. There's not enough capability in the country to build that many buildings in such a short period of time. So they're being, again, kind of frivolous with their promises, which is very dangerous because it's going to create an expectation. But he's doing this because there are elections coming up and he needs to, shall we say, portray the most, positive image because he doesn't want to lose votes. And so that's technically, that's what they say is the next step, reconstruction. But I suggest that reconstruction is going to take much longer, but there's going to be a lot of fighting over who's responsible, what kind of construction are you going to do there? Normally, it's local authorities that make those decisions. It's not the central government, right? Is the central government impose itself on the local authorities? Quite possibly, because that's what under Erdogan, the central government has done. It's kind of hard to ascertain. This is what they're saying, but this is not what's going to happen. One of the consequences of this earthquake is that you will see a large number of people leaving the area and not coming back. Those four provinces I mentioned actually represent approximately 13.5% of Turkey's population. So that is about 12 million people or 13 million people. And that's going to create, you know, let's say even if you had 3 million people not return to that region, that's going to create a pressure elsewhere in Turkey. And cities like Istanbul, Ankara, and Izmir, as being the major metropolitan centers, will receive the bulk of that refugee population. Already there is talk that rent prices have gone up by 70% in last week because as people come in and look for a place to live, naturally, as demand increases, obviously the price is going to go up. And so I think it's going to be a very uncertain time period as we go forward. And so it's kind of difficult to actually predict.
Mm-hmm. And so we have this posturing from Erdogan for the purpose of the upcoming election. But I've seen some members of Erdogan's party, AKP, pushing for the postponement of elections, which were originally slated to occur in May. Why would they pursue this move? Is it purely to try and avoid the fallout of the earthquake, or is it something else?
Well, yes, a number of people may have mentioned it, but I would say it's not many. And in fact, the government spokesman has come down quite strongly and say that this is not government policy, that there is no question of delaying the elections at the moment. Here's the issue. The elections are scheduled for May 14th, but when you look at those four provinces, and as I said, remember, 13.5% of Turkey's population resides there. I cannot see how you can hold elections in those four provinces in 3 months from now, because the devastation is so complete. You don't know where people are. You don't know yet. You don't know how many people have died. If you don't have, if residences don't exist, how are you going to ascertain who lives where in terms of going to vote? Where are you going to put the polling booths? Right. And as I said earlier, a lot of people will have moved away from the region. Are they going to be registered elsewhere? And even if they want to be registered elsewhere, I'm not sure how the process works anymore in Turkey, but I can assume that it's going to take some time because you have to prove, you know, residence, etc. So there is no, I think, conceivable way physically to hold elections on the 14th. Now, the opposition parties are insisting that the election not be delayed. What people expect is that at the very least, the election will be delayed by a month to June 14th or 23rd, something like that, because that's the absolute latest deadline by which you have to have elections. I mean, the parliaments and the president's term are over at that point, so you have to have them. The question that arises now is that, is there a legal way to postpone it beyond June? When you look at the constitution, and there's a big debate now going on in Turkey as to whether or not you can postpone the elections beyond June, because the constitution says you can only postpone elections, and that's only for a year, if you are at war. Well, this is not at war. Then the people interpret that, is this, you know, the conditions that have been created by the earthquake in some ways are worse than a war, right? So can you then say this is equivalent to war conditions? One. Two, there is also some confusion as to whether or not it's the government and parliament that makes that decision, or it is the Supreme Electoral Council. Some people have suggested that the decision will be made by the Supreme Electoral Council, in which case that body, which is a constitutional body, which is again controlled by Erdogan because he's put only his folks there mostly, they will do whatever he wants, right? So they may postpone. Now, postponement has... people think that he will postpone it because he wants to ride out the anger of this the anger generated by this earthquake. Well, I think that's an assumption that may actually be incorrect. That is to say, now there's a shock. The government pretends that it is doing things, it is promising to rebuild everything and so on and so forth. But I think the blowback will take longer. That is to say that by postponing it, let's say he postpones it by 6 months or 9 months, it may actually be at the height of people's, at the height of the blowback against the government, because people will have had time to come to grips with the impact of the calamity. That is to say, you'll have refugees. You will see that the government was to blame because they amnestied all these illegal constructions. I suspect that 6 months down the road, more people will blame the government, because more information will also come be revealed. I mean, we don't know what else is going to come out. I mean, all we know is the amnesty and the shoddy construction, but I think likelihood is that even though he controls the press, that there are enough internet and outlets out there that he doesn't control. And the Turkish public by now has become quite savvy when it comes to using the internet and computers. So they can get, if they want, information. He will not be able to control the information, especially in an atmosphere of crisis. It's one thing to control on a daily basis information. People are not going to spend time checking whether or not the government is telling you the truth if it's, you know, daily stuff or foreign policy related stuff. But when it comes to something that affects them immediately and directly, and think also from the other perspective, if rents are going up in Istanbul because of this, and even they will go up, even that 70% number is exaggerated at the moment, a week after the earthquake, you can be sure that rent prices will go up, and especially in neighborhoods that are where the people are living a little bit on the edge, right? Because refugees who come are not going to move to the high income neighborhoods, right? They're going to move into the poorer neighborhoods, right? So that's where the clash is going to come. This is what I'm saying. You cannot make a linear projection at the moment. It is possible that he will ride it out. But my guess is it's going to get worse for him the longer it takes to have elections. And when you postpone elections, of course, and people perceive that the situation is not getting better, then they're going to say, you see, he postponed the elections in order to cover up stuff. Even if it's not true, right, people will automatically assume the worst. So it's not, he's in a very difficult, he has really a pickle here. I don't know how to, how he's going to come out of it, he's going to have to make decisions, obviously, some of them may be good, some of them may be terrible.
This electoral environment was already sort of contentious. It seemed like the election was going to be close from what I was reading about it. But before, it seemed like the issue which would dominate the election was runaway inflation. And of course, these earthquakes have totally eclipsed that, at least for the moment. This electoral environment seems very tough for Erdogan and his party. How do you think he will try to recover from the fallout of these disasters and people's blaming them on the government?
Well, I just said, I mean, people are going to blame the government. I mean, let me put it this way. You have a calamity like the earthquake. Those four regions, by the way, are actually very pro-Erdogan. In three of the regions in the last election, he got more than 50% of the vote. In one region did he get only 36%, but he and his party were number one. In other words, the opposition, yes, as a totality, got more votes, but he came out number one in that province. That's Hatay. So looking at it from that perspective, these are his voters to lose, right? His dilemma is that when you have a calamity such as this one, people who are sympathetic to the opposition are not going to turn around and say, oh, look, what a great job he's doing. I'm going to vote for him. On the contrary, he will lose his base. He will lose some part of his base, let's put it this way. So I thought that before the earthquake, that because the opposition was probably going to choose as its candidate to challenge Erdogan, somebody, a colorless former bureaucrat with little imagination, although he's actually been doing quite well in the aftermath of the election, I have to say, after of the earthquake. But Erdogan beats him in most polls, I think in every poll. There are opposition leaders like the mayor of Istanbul, the mayor of Ankara, who handily would beat Erdogan. But Erdogan is in the process of eliminating at least the mayor of Istanbul by they came up with a bogus charge, political charge against him, and they sentenced him to 2 years and 7 months or something like that prison, which effectively means that he cannot run for an election, and if his conviction is in the appeal process gets approved, so to say, he will also have to abandon his position as mayor of Istanbul, right? So Erdogan is trying to maneuver, or was trying to maneuver, the electoral field so that he would run against this Mr. Kılıçdaroğlu, the main opposition leader, the colorless bureaucrat I mentioned. So I thought he had better than even chances of winning come May 14th. But now, if the elections, I mean, I don't, whether they're May 14th or August 14th, I think he and his party are in for a shock. And the question is, how does he get out of this? I don't know.
Well, Henri, we'll finish up there. Thank you for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.